more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
We did it. Now we're done. We can go home. We've set our days.
No. We have to do our disclosures and disclaimers. And then we can go home.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, disclosures.
Disclosures. We have to say things?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah. The Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this radio program. That's disclosure number one.
Yeah. Right.
Secondly, the Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, which does not approve, which does not imply that the SEC approves or disapproves. The secretary will disavow all knowledge.
I'm going to disclose about disclosure. Disclosure is defined as the act of revealing or something that is revealed. An example of disclosure is the announcement of a family secret. An example of disclosure is the family secret, which is told.
Do we have any family secrets?
I don't think so.
I don't think we have any family secrets.
Okay. Well, that would be a secret if we did.
Well, then it wouldn't be a secret. If you told it, then it wouldn't be a family secret.
So the Personal Wealth Coach, next disclosure, is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Oh, well, we can disclose. See, the definition has it being disclosed twice. It talks about what the disclosure is and then defines it as the disclosure.
Okay, we've announced that. And,
okay.
Let's see. But we don't give investment advice on this radio program.
We don't give investment advice on this radio program.
That's a disclaimer.
We disclosed it twice. So,
and,
yes.
We do give educational information. Educational information.
We give educational information.
So we've disclosed that twice. Right. That's not a disclosure. That's a disclaimer.
And we say this often enough, but the reason why we say that is because we're trying to educate people on a subject that there's very little education out there on, and that is the world of finance. Of first, how to look at the world on a big scale, and also how to look at your own finances on a much smaller scale.
A finance.
They're very, very nice
tiny
insects.
They're very, very tiny. Fine meaning
yes,
very small.
Very, very tiny.
Very,
yeah.
very tiny. We used to call them something I probably shouldn't say on the air.
I am in a social media group called Fine Ants, because there are economists that are a little bit tongue-in-cheek, if you get what I mean.
It's hard with talk.
Very hard to talk with your tongue-in-cheek, but we could do it.
Are they one-handed economists? That's the question.
No. Every economist has multiple hands. We are crossbred with octopuses.
We also need to disclose that we don't get paid to do this radio program. Yeah, in a sense we do. We get paid by the Personal Wealth Coach.
Oh, yeah. We pay ourselves.
Yeah, but we don't pay for this radio program. This is not an infomercial.
We don't pay for it. They don't pay us. We do advertise for the radio program.
On KTM.
Yes. But that's it. Senator, there is no quid pro quo.
Well, I'm not even sure if there would be a quid pro quo there.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Well, I've said there's none.
We're purely educational out here trying to educate the world, and that's our quid pro quo.
Could be. There's something else we need to say, and I don't remember what it is now.
The information
we present on this radio program has been
deemed.
Oh, here we go. Okay. Has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. Ooh, I love that.
And sometimes when
it's
we look at it twice,
we get to use.
We redeem it to be reliable.
The
first time we look at it, we say it's liable, but the second time we say it's reliable.
We make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of the information thereof.
We guarantee that we don't warranty.
I used a thereof.
Or deem thereof forsooth.
Or anti-sooth either.
We have way too much fun just with our disclaimers and disclosures.
And the telephone number in here, if today is February the 8th, I almost said January, February the 8th, 2020. If it's not February 8th, 2020, you're listening through a time warp, and that's your problem.
Maybe a rerun time warp. Yeah.
You're listening to the past. Well, you're always listening
on the internet, listening to recordings, podcasts.
Well, you're always listening to the past because there is a slight lag between the time we say this and the time they hear it. So they're always listening to the past.
Can you get with the present, please? I already heard what you just said.
Get with the president?
Oh, yeah, that too.
Okay, anyway. I forgot. Oh, yeah, the telephone number, 254-773-1400.
We've just scared everybody away. There's nobody. First, we're talking about the subject of finance, and now we're being goofy. We can't even get to finance without saying really, really bad puns.
Actually, we are far more interested in the ecology of economics. Economics.
Yes, we're eco-warriors.
Which means...
Economists, not the green
ecological
stuff. Well,
numbers.
It's green. We are green.
Well,
we're all about the green.
Eco is for ecological, which means the study of the eco.
Yes.
And numbers is what nomics means. Mm-hmm. So it's the ecological study of numbers.
Yes.
Economics.
Either that, or we could say nomics in the new definition is the noise you make while eating.
Or it could be a song from the Muppets. Manomino.
Mm-hmm. So, what's happened this week in the markets?
Did anything happen this week in the market?
Yes, something weird happened this week in the markets.
Well, we proved that the coronavirus, at least the initial symptoms of the coronavirus, are very transitory.
In the markets.
In the markets.
Yes.
That's
the symptoms of coronavirus are high fever, flu-like symptoms, and volatility in the stock market.
Right. And the stock market dropped, almost 5% at its deepest depths.
And then came back and went back down again.
And it went up and actually broke records again on Wednesday in euphoria over the fact that the coronavirus is not as bad as they thought it was didn't think it was.
And then they heard, well, maybe it is as bad as we thought,
and it
went back down.
It sagged back again. Anyway, yeah.
So this is what they're going to have to do this at all of the borders. Have you been experiencing fever, chills, aches, market volatility? Oh, yeah, market volatility. Okay, you cannot enter the country.
That's
Sorry.
It. Anyway, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is the one we look at. It was up 3.17% for the week, and that was nothing to sneeze at. Yada, 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 yada.
I see what you did there with symptoms.
The Dow is back above the 29,000 level, so all is well. Happy days are here again.
Unless you have a fever, and then you might be concerned. We're talking about the coronavirus.
By the way, apparently there is a rumor going around it has something to do with the beer.
With beer?
Corona beer.
Oh, could be.
I am not joking when I say that Corona has had to put out official statements. We have nothing to do with the virus. Corona beer sales have fallen.
Oh, no. that's an example of what's really going on in the volatility of the market and in the economy. The virus.
Corona beer.
Yeah, the virus itself. So we're going to give two different layers of this. The virus itself, the coronavirus, isn't what kills people. It's not killing a lot of people to begin with. It's secondary infections, just like the flu doesn't generally kill you. It's other things that come on when you're down with the flu that get you. Well, the coronavirus isn't going to have a massive effect on any economy as a virus because 700 people have died. The actions to prevent the coronavirus from spreading, on the other hand, have seized up huge chunks of the Chinese economy. It's the second largest economy on the planet, and huge chunks of it have just been put in pause for reactions to the virus.
There is... One of the scenarios in one of the computer simulations suggested that there is very good reason that it may affect the economy.
The makers of that computer simulator said it is not effective for use with the coronavirus because we don't know how it spreads yet.
Well, we do know how it spreads. It spreads from person to person.
Sure.
Through water droplets.
Is it touch? Is it airborne? And that question we don't know yet. So... Mm-hmm. Stepping away from someone and not shaking their hand may be enough. If not getting sneezed on may be enough, or it could be you're getting breathed on, and that's too bad. So that's what they're saying is we don't know, and most
well,
the simulations have it going from breathing, from airborne.
The point is that it's strictly anecdotal at this point. We have a caller on 773-1400. Hang on just a second. Strictly anecdotal at this point, but the doctor who first announced it, who, by the way, was arrested by the Wuhan State Police for announcing that he thought a new virus was coming out, died. And he's 24 years old and was in excellent health. Now, that makes it, and apparently the anecdotal evidence we're getting...
Is there a lot more people dying than reported?
Well, not only that, but... flu influenza, which, by the way, killed 80,000 people last year.
On the planet, yeah.
Kills mainly very old and very young or ill people.
Yeah.
People with immune deficiencies or something. But the anecdotal evidence we're getting is that there's a significant number of younger, healthy people that are dying of the coronavirus, which is what we saw in the 1918 epidemic, which we really don't understand. And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're kind of tiptoeing around kind of what I was going to address. I give you, there's a lot of media hype around this whole coronavirus, but I would also, surmise or suggest that we're getting information from a communist state which is not well known for giving out and subversiveness and, imprisoning their own people. There's a really hilarious YouTube channel I would encourage y'all to watch called China Uncensored, and it really lays out a lot of the misdeeds.
We certainly are aware of that.
Yeah, absolutely. We suspect that China, just like SARS, has very, very poorly reported the real number of deaths, the real number of people that are... They wouldn't be shutting down a city of 11 million people if only 700 people had died.
And that's why you keep hearing me use the term anecdotal. What happens is the Wall Street Journal, for example, actually has reporters in Wuhan, is that correct?
Wuhan.
Which is gutsy, scary, or they just can't get out. But the anecdotal evidence is probably more important at this point, where you can there's ways of getting around state censorship in China. For instance, the amount of coal they're using or the amount of oil they're using is easy to determine, and their economy can be deduced by the amount of fuel they're using.
The amount of fuel that they're using and the satellite pictures of their lights at night to figure out which portions of the economy are in high production mode. So there are ways of back checking.
But this particular epidemic, and I read a really good article on it that made a lot of sense to me. We really don't know that much about it at this point. Comparing it to the SARS epidemic is a very bad idea for two reasons. One, China was 3.4% of the world's economy when the SARS epidemic occurs. Now it's 16.9. The other one that's pretty significant here is this virus spreads readily from one person to another, whereas the SARS virus was very, very difficult to spread. You had to actually get bodily fluid somewhere in on a mucous membrane to get SARS, whereas this one is clearly being spread through the air.
Just as a side note, that's a different type of coronavirus. There is a whole family of coronaviruses. We're just calling this one, just like we do with the flu, it's just the flu, and when there's thousands of strains.
Yeah, it's a...
We gave SARS its own name. I mean, that seems unfair to the current coronavirus that it doesn't get its own name.
I think the caller just hung up.
Yep, he did. Or you just hung up or something.
No, it was him. Yeah. I would hang up on us,
Is this a real threat? Yes. Is it certainly a threat? No, we don't know enough to know how big of a threat it is. I can say...
We know enough to know that it's a threat to the economy.
If we get vaccines quickly, which is always... We still don't have a vaccine, by the way, for the SARS virus.
Right.
So if we get an effective vaccine working quickly, then this is a minor nothing. If not, then it is probably going to spread globally because it's whatever means of contagion, it's very highly contagious, obviously. It's kind of like influenza. It's very highly contagious.
It's contagious enough that just being around somebody might be enough.
And could this be the, quote, black swan, which means the unexpected event that tips things over into recession? It very well could be. On the other hand, it might not be. This is one of those things where, to be very frank, we just don't know.
And that's a really good segue into something I wanted to talk about.
What, we don't know? There's a universe of stuff.
Yeah, that's true. At any given moment, the economy has something wrong with it. Any moment. It doesn't matter if you're in a big boom or in the depths of a recession. There's something wrong with it that if it's not handled or if it's blown out of proportion or it affects enough confidence can cause the entire economy to slow down or to stop or go the other direction, recede. That's what recession is. That's something that makes predicting the economy more difficult, because Right now, we can point at a whole series of things that are wrong with the economy that could lead to a recession. But there are times in the past when those same things have been wrong that didn't lead to a recession. They got fixed. And that's something that's worth noting. When we say there's a high probability of recession, there's always ways out of recessions. It's the panic that causes the recession. It's the confidence shift. And diseases have a more direct pathway to your confidence than the stock market does.
We had a panic in 2018 at the end of the year, but it did not lead to a recession.
Correct.
Because the economy was stable. We don't know how unstable the economy is until it gets hit with a blow of some kind.
Right. And we have another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. You touched on it in your newsletter, but there's an article in the Wall Street Journal about everybody else is diving into the bond market, should you? And they said that records amount of money are sloshing around in bond funds. It's a sign of prudence, not folly.
There's
a lot of kinds of bonds. What kind of bonds are good bonds, and what are the ones you should stay away from?
All right. Good question. Well, you were talking about JCPenney on the way in.
Yeah,
here,
let me give you an example about people pouring into the bond fund. This is a very specific example. I was reading an article about zombie companies. JCPenney's operating income is not enough right now. If they took all of their income and they used it to pay the interest on their debt, it would not be enough. They have to keep borrowing money to stay open. But they've still got a lot of stores open because they're a zombie company. In other words, they're not for profit, but not intentionally. And they just floated a big bond issue at 9% interest, which means it's junk. And it was immediately fully subscribed. People are jumping into the bond market. They say, JCPenney, 9%. I can get 9% on my money. And JCPenney's not going to go out of business, but JCPenney is, if in a different interest rate environment, in a different environment where people weren't flocking to bonds, JCPenney would have had to declare bankruptcy.
All right. I've got a good headline here. And you know it's a good headline because the picture underneath it is of Jay Powell. Anytime you have the picture of the Federal Reserve Chairman on it, it gives some kind of weight to whatever.
Gravitas. It's called gravitas.
He actually doesn't have a whole lot to do with this article. In fact, he's not even quoted in the article, but his picture's on the article, which makes it important.
What publication is it?
It's the Financial Times. They're pretty good at this sort of thing, but I find that humorous. The headline is Global Junk Bond Issuance Hits Monthly Record. By monthly record, we mean record, all-time record for a month, ever, issuance of debt. When we call it junk bond, it means that there is a really high probability of failure of the company. So JCPenney is an example. You were just saying that. When a company is not making enough money to pay its own debt and is getting more debt to pay its debt, and does not have a path to profitability. And that word, we just had the IPO of Casper, the mattress company. They have no known path to profitability. They have a lot of sales, but they're not making any profits. So they IPO'd, their numbers went way up and then dropped way down to below IPO levels the next day. Same thing happened to Facebook, just as a side note. They didn't have a path to profitability when they IPO'd either. But they were in a different time when it was easier to take the path to profitability.
So there's two ends of the bond market right now, and they are diverging rather rapidly, and that's a sign that the end is near. Bond interest rates are going up, but
it's called the spreads between low risk and high risk.
The investment grade bonds are at not record low, but close to record low levels right now, and you can always tell how bad the bond market is getting, how overbought the bond market is getting by looking at the mortgage rates. The lower the mortgage rates go, the more money is trying to rush into the bond market and the more overpriced it is. Because low interest rates means the price of the bonds are high. I was looking, a lot of investment grade bonds that are out there on the market right now in the secondary market are trading at 110, which means they trade at 10% above their par value. Now, if interest rates go up, that means that bond could easily lose 10% in a very short period of time. And that's a lot of money. When you say it's prudent, people say bonds are safe and it's prudent, and they get their statement in and they see a 10% loss in a month, which could happen.
Very easily could happen.
Then they suddenly will decide it's not prudent and go to sell. And as they go to sell, that
so
drives interest
friends.
Rates up.
Yeah. And if their friends all sell at the same time, interest rates go up and bond prices go down. This is a bond panic. And in the 1980s, some people will remember this name. Michael Milliken. Do you remember that name?
I remember Michael Milliken quite well.
This was junk bonds. And
No, high yield.
Well, they call it high yield after, but at that point,
now we
call
them high
called
yield.
The junk bond king.
Yeah, they were called junk bonds back then. Now we call them high yield because they sound cool.
Yeah, if somebody's offering you high yield bonds, just be aware there's more risk involved in a high yield bond than in a lower yielding bond. Otherwise, they wouldn't be paying you the higher interest rate.
So to give you some idea of why I think there's dangers out there in even investment grade bonds, insurance companies that offer annuities, by definition, have investment-grade bonds. Now, I get an advertisement every time I open the Wall Street Journal digitally and most other times because they know who I am and I'm in finance. Annuity payout 9.6%.
Yeah, that's insane.
And remember that JCPenney, it would be bankrupt except for the fact that it can still borrow enough money to keep going, and it's only paying 9%. So if somebody is willing to pay you 9.6% on your money, what does that say about the financial stability of the company that's willing to pay you 9.6% on your money? It ain't there.
Yeah, and this is hard for a lot of people to grasp, but it's easier if you think of it in a personal level. If you have really good credit, you have a lot of cash in the bank, and you go for a loan for something, you're likely to get a low interest rate. Well, why? Because a lot of people want to lend to you. A lot of people are saying to you, you're a good risk. You have cash in the bank. You have good income. You pay your debts on time. Your credit score is high. If you have a bad credit score, your interest rate is going to be higher. If you have a really good credit score and someone offers you a really high interest rate loan, you're probably not going to take it. Companies are the same way. If the only loan they can get is a high interest rate loan, otherwise known as a high yield bond, that's the one they'll have to take. But know that they can't get a lower interest rate or they would, just like you would. If you have a choice between a high interest rate loan for your house or a low interest rate loan for your house, which would you choose?
So you
the companies do the same thing.
You ask what is a good, our opinion. And that's all it is. Opinions are like something else we have on our anatomy that everybody has
at least
one of.
I have at least one. More than one, I would say. My opinion is that I have a lot of opinions.
So our opinion is that short-term bonds, high-grade short-term bonds like government bonds or very, very high-grade corporate bonds are probably not at all a bad idea. Money market funds are, in effect, in very,
very, very
loose
short-term
bonds.
And sometimes they've got bank loans in there as well.
It's interesting. There are some money market funds that are paying a higher interest rate now than short-term bonds.
Yeah.
That is a short – what we have is a short-term inverted yield curve. Now, the classic definition of the inverted yield curve is when the 90-day T-bill pays a higher interest than the 10-year Treasury note.
And it's not quite there. About even at this point. Very close to even.
The point – here is that the 3-year, 5-year, 7-year, if you go out the Treasury interest rate scale until you get to 10, they are below the 90-day, and they're below the interbank rate that the Fed charges. This is an indication that the bond market is, in effect, predicting sometime in the next few years we're going to have a recession. Now, is that necessarily an accurate prediction? No, the bond market is not always 100% right, but it's something to pay attention to. Is when the consensus of all the people who are trading supposedly safe short-term money are concluding that interest rates will be lower in the future than they are today, in the near future. That is an indication that the economy is going to slow down in the near future, in their opinion.
On the other hand, see what I did there with the hands and the economist thing? On the other hand, there's some good news in the bond market as well.
The amount of negative yielding debt. Man, that's a weird concept. Someone is paying, in essence, if you were getting a loan from the bank at a negative yield, the bank would be paying you to use their money. But they would like it back when you're done. But the part that they pay you to use the money, you can keep. This is a little weird. But the amount of negative yielding went from about $17 trillion globally, close to middle point of 2019. It was shrinking down through December and then started growing again December, January, and now into February. So we went from $17 trillion. We dipped down to about 13.5, and now we're back up to $14 trillion of negative yielding, and that's weird.
Well, negative interest rates are kind of interesting. If you are getting an interest rate on your money that's less than probable inflation into the future,
in effect, you have got a negative yield.
A negative yield. It's just very thoroughly disguised.
If you have a negative yield and it's not accounting for inflation yet, you have a very thoroughly negative yield.
There's a lot of savings accounts and even certificates of deposit and money market funds that pay a fraction of 1% when inflation is conservatively running about 1.7%.
Yeah, I was looking around at some major banks just looking at interest rates. A lot of banks are starting to pick up the high-yield savings account positions, but they have things like you've got to have $15,000. And the private banks, the ones that are outside, they're not really banks. They're not regulated by the Federal Reserve.
You mean the non-bank bank?
The non-bank banks that are really – that's a scary issue by itself. So SoFi and SoftBank and PayPal and Robinhood, and there's a lot of these entities out there that have high yield savings. The insurance on it is not FDIC. A lot of them have insurance, but it's not FDIC. So insurance companies fail as well, and that's an important thing. Banks with FDIC are generally not paying high yield savings rates. Some of them are. So looking around at the major banks, most major banks, if you have less than $15,000, are paying about 0.1%. When you look at the Federal Reserve, which is what a 2.25 is what they're paying banks. So what the banks are doing, if a bank puts their own money into the Federal Reserve System for loans.
1.5 to 1.7,
okay.
I thought it was.
Okay, if that's what it is. Are you sure that it's not up to the 2.25?
No, it's the 1.5. Roughly, they're paying the banks 1.5%.
We can look it up. I believe you, but I'd like to get the Fed funds rate. Come on here. It changes enough. It's at 2% right now.
Really?
Yeah. So, it was at 2.25 when they lowered it earlier in the year.
Well, you got me then.
So, the long term, the U.S. Fed funds rate is projected to trend around 2%. Well, that's the projection from the Fed. I don't know. So maybe you're right. There we go. Effective federal funds rate is 1.55.
That's it.
There you go. You are correct. So, when we're looking at the federal funds rate at 1.55, the bank can get a loan, or basically you deposit in the bank, and that's getting a loan from you because they owe you that money. Then they can turn around and loan it to the Fed at the fund rate, at the federal fund rate. They can go to the repo rate and get a higher rate. This is why there's not a huge amount of new mortgage loans. There's a lot of refinances for people with good credit. They're actually extending that into people that have less credit now. And so there's some education opportunity there. We're talking a lot about interest rates being low. Let's throw this out there. If you look at your interest rate on your mortgage, here are the things to look at to decide if you need to refinance. So ask these questions to yourself. What's my current interest rate? If your current interest rate is above about 4.5% if you have good credit, and you plan on staying in your house, how long? 5 years or more? 2 years or more? If you can save enough money on the refinance, so then you have to start getting quotes to say,
okay, what's the interest rate they'll be offering? If you can save more than about a percentage point and the closing costs can get recouped in a short period of time, it's worth refinancing or at least looking at it. If the expenses on it are something that are going to last the next 3 years to get paid back and you only intend on staying in the house for another year, you're actually losing money by refinancing to a lower rate. So keep that in mind. If you have a 10 years left on your mortgage and you refinance at 30 years, that may not be a good thing. If you're trying to get it paid off and you're not really, really hurting for money, refinance maybe, but continue to pay at the same amount per month. And then you can have that paid off in less than 10 years. So there are a lot of ways of looking at this. Get educated on it and get quotes. Don't have them run your full credit check until you're pretty clear that you like the rates and the deal that you've got. Because every time they run a hard credit report, your credit rate gets hit. Your credit score gets hit. So that's just, we're talking about loans right now. It is a borrower's paradise right now. So if you have a high interest rate on your home, you should start looking around at the very least.
The other indicators about the future, reflecting the immediate future, is the price of oil. Oil prices are affected by certain things short term, but right now, everything out there that would affect it short term should be pressing the price of oil up. The Saudis and the Russians are talking about OPEC and the Russians are talking about reducing their output, trying to raise the price of oil, which normally would cause an oil price spike. But the price of oil during the week dropped 2.38%. It's now down almost 18% from the beginning of the year. This is an indicator. This is the oil's futures market we're talking about. This is an indicator that the oil market is reflecting supply and demand, anticipated demand and anticipated supply. And the supply hasn't changed. As a matter of fact, if anything, it's decreased just a little bit. And the price still went down very substantially. 2.38% is a big drop in the price of oil in a single week. And that is very simply because the oil markets, the people who buy and sell in the oil market, which are by the people who, largely the people who ship oil around, are concluding that there's going to be a lot less oil used in the near future than we're using right now. And remember I told you we could deduce the GDP of China by the amount of oil and coal they're importing, because they don't produce, we know how much they produce, which isn't a lot. So they have to import their own oil, and since they have to import it in ships and they have to get the ships and the oil from someplace else, it's possible to go around and say, here's how much oil China is importing. And by looking at the amount of oil they're importing, we can tell how much oil they're burning, and that will lead us to a very solid image of what their GDP is. I know they use a lot of wind farms, and they use a lot of solar panels and all of that, but it still isn't significant in size of the total economy of China. And with the price of oil dropping like this, the oil market, the people who actually ship oil and whose livelihood depends on it, are saying there's a global economic slowdown coming and we're going to pay less for oil because and matter of fact, right now, the demand for oil globally has been falling rather dramatically. These are all indications that something's going on. Now, whether the trick here, if there's a trick to this, an important thing to do when you see these statistics, they're real. But we have to give them time to see if it's a blip or if it's longer term. And we don't throw away we don't just blow them off. We have to pay attention to them. And the bottom line to this is pretty simple. The economy is, the world economy and the U.S. economy is on kind of a knife's edge right now. We could, if things go really, really well, if trade with China were to accelerate.
And this is something that's important to know. This week, a big thing happened. They dropped tariffs on $74 mm-hmm. billion dollars worth of goods that we send to them.
But when we see prices moving in such a way that it indicates that commerce is slowing down, that buying and selling is where money is made and where GDP is created, is in buying and selling. And when you've got Caterpillar, as we see, forecasting lower earnings, lower revenue for the rest of the year, And because they can see their orders well in advance, and because they have to build the stuff after they get the orders, and they're saying, we're just not getting as, we're seeing a decreasing quantity of orders for new equipment. And we see the oil markets making the same prediction by saying, we're seeing a drop off in orders for oil. This is an indication that there's, this is a leading indicator.
A bellwether.
That something is happening out there. And of course, we can point at the SARS virus as a probable cause
you
of that.
You mean coronavirus.
The coronavirus.
Unless we were in Time Machine. Bill and Ted have that one, I don't think.
I keep getting it mixed up with the Corona beer, too. The coronavirus as the proximate indicator, but it's kind of like, here's an example, if I could go on here a little
sure,
bit.
Sure, yeah.
You could have a privacy fence around your yard, and it stood for years, and it seems to be perfectly stable, and then a little thunderstorm comes along, and it knocks it over.
Uh-huh.
The thunderstorm may be the proximate cause of the fence falling over.
But the fence was going to fall over from
right.
some storm.
Because what's happening is beneath the ground where you can't see it, the fence posts have been rotting. And
right.
that little gust of wind, you say, well, the windstorm blew my fence over and I should have it fixed, but by the insurance because it was wind damage. And the insurance company may go for that, but they probably shouldn't.
They might look at your termite ridden base posts for your privacy fence and go, well, you may have had a problem that existed before the wind came along.
And that's why when you get your roof repaired after a hailstorm, you find sometimes the insurance company doesn't pay for it all. And the reason they don't pay for it all is because your roof has been there for 20 years or 7 years or 10 years. And the longer it's there, the more unstable it gets until it collapses, which is why we need to have recessions from time to time. If we don't have receptions, we have more rot in the system.
Yeah, it's a time
and the
when
smaller the thing that can. That at some point, something will come along and provide just enough kick to cause the system to partially shut down.
Now, there's a conflicting quote by Abraham Lincoln. Whether or not he actually said it, it's kind of irrelevant. It's a good quote. If you have all day to cut down a tree, how will you do it? And he said, I'd spend the first half of the day or some. There's a lot of references to this quote. It's got different time frames. Sharpening my axe. If you think of our economy as tools and you think about retooling or sharpening the axe, we haven't had a lot of time to do that. We've been too effective, too busy, just keeping going. We need a recession so that we have the time to retool so that we can have further growth in the future. That's just the way it goes. People have quite often in recent 2 years or so, been saying to me, you're so pessimistic. Why do you keep saying there's a recession coming? Because it's kind of like being the meteorologist that's saying there may be rain in the future. It's not pessimism. It's realism. We haven't stopped having recessions.
I'm going to be very, very astute here and make a forecast.
Okay.
Commercials are about to come.
Okay. And we're going to play some commercials.
See,
how
I told
did you know that?
See?
He is, ladies and gentlemen, mark down on your calendars that our predictions come true at least 1% of the time. we're going to play some commercials and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is
254-773-1400.
All right. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We do that so well.
We think we do. We can
I mean,
say
how many
our
people?
Names.
How many people can say their names? Two people can say their names like that.
I want to ask you this because I've never been complimented on our ability to say our names together on the radio program, except by each other.
Lynn Woolley has complimented us on that.
I think he did it with it. Yeah, guys, he tapped me on the head when he said it. He said, "Good job, you." Yeah. I don't know that anybody else finds it quite as amazing as we do that we can say our names together.
That's because nobody else does it.
Well, they don't say our names together.
That's true. That's true. Okay. Well, let's see. We still have a few minutes left in the first hour.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to hit on this. Larry Kudlow is saying that China has said that they're going to meet all of their trade obligations even with the coronavirus. So I wanted to throw that out there. And the fact that they've lowered the tariffs. It sounds like they're concerned about the trade war still enough to be following along with the deal, even with the coronavirus going. But it's going to put some stress on them. It's interesting. Hopefully it doesn't lead to distress.
Yep. The they say they're going to buy all that stuff, and we'll see if it. But again, let me say, Mr. Market is somebody we think probably makes pretty good decisions. And Mr. Market has noted that Mr. Market decided not to raise the price. Mr. Market, by the way, is the collective wisdom of all the buyers and sellers in any given market. The price of soybeans after the trade agreement dropped 7.5% in the 2 weeks following the trade agreement. And that is, like, why? I mean, if the Chinese are going to buy literally more soybeans than we produce in the next year, then the price of soybeans should have risen, but it didn't. It dropped instead. It was already down before because of the trade tension, and then it dropped further after the trade agreement. Now, I cannot in my wildest dreams figure out how the market, the people who buy futures contracts on soybeans, guessed that the price of soybeans the demand for soybeans should be lower in the future, or else we've got an oversupply, when farmers have notably, after the tariffs hit and the Chinese said, we're not buying soybeans from you anymore, we'll buy them from Brazil instead. So farmers this last year planted fewer soybeans, which means we don't have as many soybeans as we used to. And the Chinese are about to buy more soybeans than we produce, theoretically. But the price of soybeans went down. This is worth watching, by the way, very carefully.
Yeah, we're still down. So back, let me see here, in June, soybeans per bushel. Yes, we still measure the prices of things in bushels. You did learn that correctly in school.
Yes.
The price of soybeans per bushel was $10.54. So come forward to today. That was so April, June of 2018. Come forward to today. You're talking February 7th is the last day we had the price on there, $8.82 a bushel.
That's a substantial drop.
Yeah, that is a significant drop. It's a 20% drop in the price after we have an agreement to buy a bunch of it. That says something. Well, we don't know what it says, but it says something.
There's something out there that's not obvious. And the point is that the prices were holding steady leading up to the agreement. The agreement was signed, and within 2 weeks, the price of soybeans is down 7.5%. That is one of those things that there is a cause to that effect, but we don't know what the cause is, and nobody is publishing anything about it that I can find. And it's been noted by economists and people who follow the futures markets as a very curious thing. There's a lot of possibilities, like people who had bought futures contracts with the thinking that, okay, this will blow over and the Trump administration is just bluffing and the Chinese will buy a lot of soybeans, and sold them all once the deal was sold. There's always some possibilities going one way or the other, but this is a big differential, and by everything that's published, shouldn't be there. But it's there anyway, and that's like the price of oil. The economists that I've read have said the coronavirus will have very little or no effect on the economy. Even in worst case scenario, it's going to have this tiny, 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 insignificant effect. And yet, the price of oil is dropping. And if you get, I don't know if the economists figured this in, because we are, contrary to what was said, we're not the largest exporter of oil in the world.
No.
We're the largest producer, but not the largest exporter by far.
We're self-reliant, and we produce a lot more, but we use a lot of oil. So we're the number one oil user in the world as well.
We're mostly self-reliant.
Yeah, we're self-reliant.
We produce more oil than we use, but we don't have the pipelines to get the oil to where we need it. So we have to import oil from the East Coast, for example.
We import a lot of oil for refining purposes as well. So this is interesting. All the stuff going on in Venezuela. It's a big deal. It's a nasty thing happening in Venezuela. They still occasionally have tankers getting Citgo oil, which is Venezuela-owned oil, into Houston for refining. You can still drive up to the Citgo station and buy from it. So people say, hey, we're not getting oil from Venezuela anymore. No, it's still happening. Citgo is a Venezuelan-owned company. Now, the fact that the Venezuelans have the American CEO of the company that they own in a prison in Caracas is part of the reason why I'm saying this is a weird situation. They have the president or the CEO of a company that they own in prison because he's also American. It's just conundrum on that for a moment.
Speaking of American, we have a telephone call on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. This is a question, and it does concern value of money. You know, any type of material item that has beneficial to people has value, okay? What I'm trying to get to, sir, you know, oil. Okay, when you talk about oil, where did oil originally come from? I've heard myths from the ocean, you know, from hundreds and millions and thousands of years, you know, when fish die, their oily substance turns into that material. And that was the question I wanted to ask you. You have a good day. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is a process that we can replicate these days. You can replicate it by breaking down bacteria over time. So it's a bacterial sludge that turned into oil. We can produce diesel just as, I mean, from fish or from cattle or from anything with fat, from soybeans, we can produce diesel, which is it is chemically very, very similar. By very similar, you do just some additive genetic traits that are different, to the stuff that we get out of the ground. There's just been a lot of bacteria over a very long period of time rotted up and produced oil.
There were times in history when the sea levels are much higher and the earth was much warmer. And, for instance, this part of the world that we're in right now was covered by a very shallow sea and a lot of sunlight was hitting it.
And you can prove that by going out and digging up fossils. If you've got seashells all over the place, that means this was ocean.
So there are lots of biological material out there that was living and dying and settling to the bottom and rotting. And it was gradually pressed down under other biological material and gradually got deeper and deeper and deeper into the earth. And as it got deeper into the earth, the pressure and the heat rotted it in an anaerobic environment, no oxygen. And as this rotting occurred, it separated into oil and solids. And the oil tended to rise because it's lighter than water. And it tended to get caught in salt domes and things like that, which is why we look for salt domes when we drill in Texas.
And where did that salt come from?
Caught salt in shale. The shale oil, for example, comes out of shale. Shale was once mud.
Yeah, and shale, if you just think of a chalkboard, that's slate. It's a form of shale.
Right. It was pressurized mud, and gradually the bacteria and the organic material in there got pressed out and heated over millions of years, literally. And then the oil separated from the other solid material. Now, for example, coal was formed very much the same way. It just didn't get as much heat.
This is the story of coal. All coal on the planet was formed during the same time period.
The Carboniferous period.
It was a period where lignins were developed. What is a lignin? Lignin is the stuff that makes a tree trunk stiff. A plant stem stiff. Before that, all plants were pretty close to the ground, and bacteria was really good at rotting them away, at eating them up and making them turn back into soil. Lignins were developed by some plant, and when that happened, it spread pretty rapidly across the planet, the ability to produce lignins.
So you just said it didn't get a good patent on that?
No, it didn't. I mean, it was intellectual property violation everywhere because nobody was intellectual at the time.
Okay.
So lignins caused trees. And the bacteria were a little slow. It took them about 300 million years to figure out how to eat lignins. So just think of a forest where there were just trees stacked on top of each other because every time they fell down. So the layer of coal that exists across the planet, everywhere in the planet, it's the same layer. It's about 300 million years of trees that put themselves under pressure with stuff on top of it, just compressing with no bacteria. That's that anaerobic environment that you're talking about. No bacteria is involved in that particular instance. It just carbonated All of the carbon is what's left. This is why when you make charcoal, you don't have oxygen in there. You burn the fire in an anaerobic environment. You get rid of everything else. So the lignin was the only stuff that the bacteria couldn't eat. That's what's left. And we're about out of time. Just a little piece of useless trivia.
No, that's very useful. That's a very important thing. It's the kind of stuff that kids learn in elementary school that we used to learn in college.
Yeah. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give personalized fiduciary investment advice through our office in Salado, Texas. We have a voicemail during the weekend, and real live people answer the phone during the work week. Locally, the phone number is
254-947-1111. I have 1111 on there so I can remember it.
Yeah. You can reach that number if you aren't using a cell phone. There, most people are. But we have a toll-free number just in case you still have a landline, 1-800-914-7526. That's the same voicemail, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Or if you're feeling less typey, you can just put in four letters, tpwc.com, as in The Personal Wealth Coach. You'll see our made-for-radio faces almost immediately upon getting to that website. You'll see our beautiful staff, the building that we do our business through.
You can also email us at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com.
That's correct. There's a contact form on there. We've got newsletters that have been up for quite a long time. If you want to sign up for our newsletter, you can do it there. You can listen to recordings of the program. And until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.